In my family, education means cultivating wisdom and virtue by teaching what is good, true, and beautiful. Memoria Press makes this type of education possible with their classical Christian curriculum. Characterized by simplicity, quality, and affordability, Memoria Press gives my children a rich classical education. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
I don't know how you could look at a baby or look at the parts of a baby and not have some kind of compassion or heart-wrenching question about what you're doing.
What the Apostle Paul says in Ephesians 3 is that the church is a sign to the principalities and powers in the heavenly places. So the church is an outpost of the coming kingdom of God.
There's a broad road that leads to destruction, and there's a narrow path that leads to eternal life. And T.D. Jakes' answer puts people on and keeps them on the broad road that leads to destruction.
I jokingly called this the Issues Etc. Revolution, the near complete sweeping out of the old guard that emphasized church growth practices down the line.
When we were talking last time with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris in our series on the victims of the sexual revolution, we were talking about, no-fault divorce. Now, the one thing we didn't get to that I'd like to hear in a few minutes with her is how men have fared under no-fault divorce. The picture that you might have in your mind is that men have been kind of freed up from this. They can marry and then put away their wives and move on to other places. They can basically be what men were evolutionary built to be. They're just going to be like the buck tromping through the woods looking for one doe after another. Is that the truth? Have men benefited in any way economically, much less socially, from a no-fault divorce culture? We're going to be talking about that and the hookup culture with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris, part five of our series with her on the sexual revolution. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're coming to you live this September the 2nd. Thanks for tuning us in. A little bit later, we'll spend some time with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, beginning a weekly series with him on Christian apologetics. Today, we're going to talk about divine authorship of the sources of Holy Scripture. After that, in hour two of Issues Etc., pornography and adultery will be the subject. Dr. Lucas Woodford, Collegium Fellow for Doxology, the Lutheran Center for Spiritual Care and Counsel. He'll be talking with us about that. And then Ken Samples joins us. There's a TV series on the History Channel called Ancient Aliens. It has some people wondering what's going on. We'll see what Ken Samples has to say. Now, we'd like to know what you have to say, questions or comments. For the next 2 hours, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, tweet @issuesetc. Our beloved on-demand listeners, wherever, whenever you listen, use the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us for part five of our series on the sexual revolution, we're going to continue our conversation on no-fault divorce and then the hookup culture. Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris, founding president of the Ruth Institute based in San Marcos, California. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities, and she's author of the new book, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
The last time we were talking about no-fault divorce, you said that in a no-fault divorce culture and in a legal sense, the law takes the side of the party who wants the marriage the least. Why is that a problem?
Well, it's a problem because, first of all, it means that the government is actively coming between people in the marriage house. So no matter what the church has to say about it, no matter what our religious beliefs might be, the government is saying that marriage is a short-term contract between people, and it has no particular social significance. There's no particular issue of social justice of staying together for the sake of children. The impact on children is pretty much no longer part of the law. You know, it's no longer a major consideration. So the state has basically redefined marriage to be an impermanent relationship between two adults that is also not sexually exclusive. So the sexual exclusivity understanding of marriage, that went away with no-fault divorce because it meant that an adulterous spouse would not be punished in any way. Not only would they not be punished, But they would be free to go off and marry the person that they're cheating on their spouse with, you know. So the whole understanding of marriage as being both permanent and sexually exclusive is really undermined by no-fault divorce. And that's why that one seemingly small policy innovation has turned out to have such devastating long-term consequences.
Speaking of victims of the sexual revolution, how have men how have they fared under no-fault divorce and in the family courts since no-fault divorce?
Well, you know, at first people thought, well, men are going to be the ones taking advantage of this, and, you know, they'll put away their wives, and the wife who has worked, who's worked in the home for a long period of time will not have any protection. And indeed, there was a sort of a short-term effect that was like that. But within a very short period of time, the courts started, two things started happening. First of all, the courts started reinterpreting spousal settlements, property settlements, and so on, to take that into account, at least to some extent. And the second thing that happened is that women quit putting themselves into that position where they'd be vulnerable. So women don't work to put their husbands through medical school anymore, for example. That used to be a very common thing, that women would work and put their husbands through medical school, and then she would stay home and take care of their children. Well, nobody does that anymore because it doesn't make any sense. So that short period, that period of time where men seemed to benefit from no-fault divorce, that period went away very quickly. That window closed very quickly. And so what frequently happens now, it depends on how the courts behave, and it varies somewhat state by state. But what a woman can do if she wants is to say, well, you know what, I'm going to get spousal support or child support out of my husband. And if I don't have to deal with him anymore, if I don't have to, if I get permanent custody, if I get primary custody, meaning, you know, substantially more than 50-50, then I can raise my kids the way I want without having to deal with him, put up with him, and he has to give me money. This is a good deal. And so that has happened. And so it isn't unusual for men to be given child support payments that really they can't meet, in the sense that they can't both meet their child support obligations and survive on their own without in an independent house that, the guy's basically supporting two households. So no-fault divorce has, in many cases, been harmful to men, put men into a very bad position that is almost impossible to meet. And, you know, you hear this, you hear all kinds of stories that people will tell you about their personal experience with no-fault divorce. And, you know, you'll hear women say ways in which they've been harmed, and you'll hear men say ways in which they've been harmed. And I don't doubt that all of those stories are true. But the fact is that there's no longer presumption that the father belongs in the home and that it's his responsibility and job to personally provide for and personally protect his children. He's the one who has been marginalized from the family the most. And so I think that's why you see suicide so much higher among men who've been divorced than men who are not divorced. And there isn't that same kind of big impact of suicide on suicide for divorce for women. So it has not been a good thing. There's really no winner in a certain way of looking at it, which seems odd. But the divorce industry has benefited. The feminist movement, so-called, they have benefited. But individual men and women and certainly children, you know, there have been an awful lot of losers.
How has pop culture, you've written some time ago about how pop culture has a tendency to gloss over the problems in our society, especially when it comes to the agenda of the sexual revolution. How have they depicted divorce culture?
Well, you know, that's very interesting because, you know, you'll never see pop culture or the news media or academic life. You'll never see anybody officially saying divorce is bad. You'll never see that. But you will quite often see in movies and TV programs, it isn't unusual to see the truth about divorce depicted in a subtle way. You know, so they won't blast you and say, gee, isn't this terrible? But they will show you what it's like for a family to have four different homes that they visit on Christmas. So there was a movie out a few years ago called Four Christmases, I think it was called. And it was about a couple both of whose parents had been divorced. And so on Christmas Day, they had to visit four different families, divorced and remarried, by the way. And so they had to visit four different families. And so in the course of doing that, I mean, that was the plot structure. That's what was, you know, the source of all the laughs and all of that. But in the process of it, you could see the pain that people were experiencing, and you could see the divorce hadn't really solved a lot of the problems. The people who were doofuses were still doofuses. The problems that they had still got transferred to just a new and different arena, but they didn't really solve the problem. They were really facing the problem. They were kind of running from the problems. And so even though that film, for example, didn't say, gee, isn't divorce terrible, they didn't say that. But as you look at it, you go, oh, yeah, look at that's familiar. The experience is familiar to people. And I like to write about those things when they do come up. I like to write about it and point out, you know, that even in pop culture, we can't help ourselves. We can't help but see that there's a problem here.
I remember back, well, this was when I was probably a very early teenager. Dustin Hoffman made a movie. I think it was with Meryl Streep, if I'm not mistaken, Kramer versus Kramer, and the whole plot structure of that movie was about their rather, I think they were trying to depict a mature divorce. But the character that I think I remember the most, other than those Oscar awarded actors, is the guy who played the kid. And that movie depicted, at least in some part, although it kind of had a happy ending, it depicted what happens to a kid when his mom and dad are going through divorce. What are your thoughts there?
Well, if you're going to show the child at all, that's what you're going to see. You know, you're going to see that this is hard on the child. There was this recent movie called Boyhood. It was the same kind of thing. It showed a family over 12 years, and it was supposedly a wonderful movie because they showed it. They had the same actors every single year, and they filmed it over 12 years, and so you saw the development of this family. But if you look at it from the child's point of view, you can't help but see that there are big problems here. And so that's what you saw in Kramer versus Kramer. There are any number of films that have that feature to it. And when they don't show that, you can see that there's something missing in the film, or the film will have a kind of wooden quality to it. There's a movie I'm thinking of, and I can't bring up its name right now. But there was a movie that was trying to depict how terrible the 50s were. And I probably shouldn't even bring it up because I can't remember the movie. But part of the way they got away with showing how terrible the 50s were is that they never showed any children in the movie. You know, they showed the adults and all of their angst and why they should not be living the way they were living and how terrible and hard and sad it was for the adults. But they never showed a single child in the movie. And so therefore, it's like, okay, well, I guess they should get divorced, you know. And so that's part of the strategy, and I think people should see that's part of the rhetorical strategy that gets used here in order to defend the divorce culture from serious criticism. So I think it's important for Christians, when you see movies like this, to find the language to name what you just saw, you know, to name the fact that this child is suffering from divorce. But nobody said that, but there it is right there. And let's us call attention to it because it deserves some attention.
Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris is our guest. She's founding president of the Ruth Institute. Her latest book is called The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims. We're in part 5 of our series with her. When we come back, The Hookup Culture.
I'm not a Christian, but I listen to your show because actually you do have some interesting topics.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
You believe that there's not one error in the Bible. That's intellectually infantile. You also believe that Jesus is coming again. You promote extremely sexually repressive views.
The Issues Etc. comment line. Available 24/7. 618-223-8382.
Have fun waiting for Jesus to return. Got news for you. He ain't coming back.
You might wonder, is it possible for my child with special needs to receive a rich classical Christian education? Issues Etc. guest Cheryl Swope answers yes. With the Simply Classical curriculum created by Cheryl and published by Memoria Press, there's no reason to withhold a beautiful education from any struggling student. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR. classicalspecialneeds.com.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I like being female, and I have never felt even remotely bad about being female. I don't know if that's because I've always steadfastly avoided women's magazines, which I think are just designed to make you feel bad.
Journalist Molly Ziegler-Hemingway speaking at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
But I've always known that being female is pretty awesome. And the only time it actually occurs to me to even feel remotely bad about it is when feminists start telling me that I'm doing everything wrong. And I think it's so interesting that feminists have such a problem with these traits that we do associate with women a little bit more. Feminists are on this campaign to make women more like men.
You can listen to Molly's presentation, Making the Case for the Differences Between Men and Women, and teachings by Paul Meyer, David Menton, Will Whedon, Chris Roseborough, and Jonathan Fisk on an audio DVD from the 2015 Making the Case conference. We'll send it to you for a donation of $300 before Labor Day. Just click the DVD logo at issuesetc.org. Sometimes I want a brand new day. Try to fit in where I don't belong. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's part five of our series on the sexual revolution, talking about the hookup culture with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, author of the new book, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims. You'll find out more about this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Jennifer, they used to call it casual sex. That's late 80s lingo there. What's the difference between casual sex and the hookup culture?
I don't know. I don't know that there is a difference. I mean, 20 years, you know. I mean, the idea is that you can have sex with anybody you want, anytime you want, not have any kind of commitment or relationship with them, and everything will turn out just fine. There's no downside to doing that, you know. That's the basic idea. And that idea has been around since, you know, the mid-70s, really. You know, I was dealing with that when I was in college, and it's still out there. And, you know, it's like every generation of students goes into college and has to deal with the same things over and over again. And in fact, young people are dealing with it at younger and younger ages, you know. And so one has to ask, why isn't anybody saying there's something wrong with the basic premise here, rather than trying to somehow tape people together with duct tape and baling wire after the harm has been done?
Now, let's talk about some of those presuppositions behind the hookup culture. There are a lot of them, but one that you point out is this idea that sex is no big deal.
Yep. Yep, that's a huge thing. You know, sex is no big deal. You shouldn't have any guilt feelings about doing it first off, and you shouldn't really care very much about it. You know, if it feels good, do it kind of a thing. But if that's the case, why do we care about people being talked into unwanted sex? Why do people care about somebody telling other people about their sexual encounters? You know, a few years ago, there was that young man whose roommate videotaped him having sex. It was homosexual sex, as it turned out, but his roommate videotaped him in the bedroom, you know, in their room doing something. And the boy was really embarrassed, and he was so embarrassed that he committed suicide over it. Well, if sex is really no big deal, why would he be embarrassed about it, you know? So these kinds of things illustrate to us that there's something wrong with the basic premise, you know? The idea that you could be, that rape is the, that being talked into something you don't really, really want to do, that that's the equivalent of rape. There's something wrong with that idea, because people talk each other into going to basketball games that they didn't really want to go to, or, I mean, I suppose not in Indiana, or Illinois over there. People get talked into going out for Mexican when they'd really rather have Chinese, you know, but nobody thinks that's a big deal, right? That is really a no big deal kind of a thing. But being talked into having a sexual encounter that it turns out you didn't really want to have, that actually is a really big deal. And it hurts people, and people care about it. And the same people who say sex is no big deal on the one hand are continually up in arms when somebody turns around and says, gee, that wasn't exactly what I want, therefore it's the equivalent of rape. And somehow they don't see the contradiction to it. As Christians, we can see that sex actually is a big deal. And that's why you have all kinds of complex feelings about it under the best of circumstances and certainly under the worst of circumstances. You have all kinds of feelings. And so that's what I try to point out in this section of the book, is a way in which our culture simply refuses to come to terms with the fact that sex is actually a big deal.
What does it, we talked in an earlier episode about the effect that cohabitation has on future marriage relationships. What in the world would multiple hookups, what kind of effect would it have on future marriage relationships?
Well, I think that, you know, there is some data on that, although I don't quote it in the book here. There is some data on the idea that starting your first sexual, having your first sexual encounter very young versus having it after you're 24 increases your chances of later divorce and instability and things like that. But, you know, just as a common sense kind of thing, what tends to happen to people is that they become jaded. You know, they think it's no big deal, so they treat it like it's no big deal, and then the other person treats them like it's no big deal. And so the spiral becomes negative, you know, instead of each encounter building up something positive, which is what's supposed to happen inside marriage. What happens is that each encounter builds up something negative and a negative understanding of what sex is really all about. And a lessened ability, a lessened capacity to really attach to people when you truly want to attach to people. I just can't understand how people can think that if you spend 10 years having casual contraceptive sex, and then you get married and now you want to deeply commit yourself and you want every single act to be deeply meaningful, I don't know how you're supposed to get from one stage to the other. You know, nobody's ever explained that to me. How 10 years of one thing, of casual sex, where you accept the premise that it's completely meaningless, how you're supposed to transition on your wedding night to deeply meaningful each and every time. You know, I don't know how that works. And I don't think it does work, as a matter of fact.
Well, we haven't even discussed the issue of multiple partners, even if contracepted, is still an enormous health risk as well. I mean, but the answer, of course, that's always given by the sexual revolution is protected sex.
That's right. That's right. And protected means use a condom. That's really all they mean by protected sex. If you they create the impression that if you use a condom every time, you've protected yourself from every risk that's worth thinking about or talking about or worrying about. So the condom doesn't protect you from a broken heart. The condom doesn't protect you from feeling used. And the condom doesn't always protect you from pregnancy or STDs. And it certainly doesn't protect you from every STD. And I think the people who promote that concept of, you know, let's always use protection, I can't believe they don't know that, you know, that it doesn't protect you from every single STD and that it doesn't work perfectly every time. And furthermore, you know, people say that we're unrealistic, Todd. They say, you know, you're unrealistic in saying that kids have to be abstinent. Well, you know what? I think they're unrealistic telling young kids that it's all going to be great as long as you use a condom every single time. Kids are not going to use a condom every single time. I got news for you. The same kids that can't be asked to be abstinent, also, you really can't tell them to use a condom every single time. So there's a contradiction built into the thing. And at least when we say to people, it would be better for you if you did not have sex until you were married, at least we're giving them a goal that's worth working for and explaining to them why that goal is worth working for and how they can recover if they stumble and fall.
I guess we could say, looking back on the beginnings of the sexual revolution, we didn't quite know the biology of sex. I mean, we knew how sex worked, but we didn't know what the effect it had on the brain. But now we do. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that's a really interesting point because people, I'm not sure what people were thinking in the 60s, but by now we do know that the sexual act is a very complex act. and it stimulates hormones in the bodies of the men and the women, and that those hormones create all kinds of feelings, including, especially for women, feelings of attachment, and to some extent for men as well, feelings of attachment, and feelings of possessiveness. That has now been studied pretty thoroughly, so that we now know that having sex does something different to the relationship. You know, it's not just a physical act. Every relationship is a physical event, you know, and so if every relationship is a physical event, that means that the physical acts you participate in as part of that relationship are going to in turn have a feedback effect on the relationship itself and how you feel and everything. And so we now know that information, and I don't see why we don't talk about it more. You know, Dr. Miriam Grossman wrote a wonderful book a few years ago talking about the hookup culture. The book was called Unprotected. And Dr. Grossman, as you may remember, was a psychiatrist who worked at the UCLA Student Health Clinic. And in that book, she writes about students coming into her asking for antidepressants. And just lots of young ladies, especially, coming in asking for antidepressants. And so, you know, while she's sitting there writing the prescription, she'll say to them, well, you know, what's going on in your life? And she would find out, time after time, she would find out that they were depressed over their hookups, you know, that the depression started, you know, a week after they got involved with a guy at a frat party, and then the guy never called them back, or, you know, a week after they had just broken up with somebody or found out that their person was going out with another girl, or, you know, whatever it was. But all of those things that Dr. Grossman was seeing were psychological and even physiological responses to hookups gone wrong. And you simply can't correct all of that stuff with a condom. You know, that is not a scientifically valid thing to be saying. There's just much more going on than preventing the semen from crossing the barrier and getting into the vagina. You know, that's all a condom can do. And there's much, much more going on in a sexual act.
Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse is founding president of the Ruth Institute, based in San Marcos, California. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities, and she's author of the new book, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims. Jennifer, thank you very much for being our guest.
You're very welcome, Todd. Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to start a brand new series, a weekly series with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on Christian apologetics. We're going to start with the sources, in essence, introducing ourselves again, at least apologetically, to the source of divine revelation, talking about the divine authorship of the Old and the New Testament. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest when we come back. Bethany Lutheran College is pleased to sponsor Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio. Bethany Lutheran College is located in the picturesque river town of Mankato, Minnesota, and is committed to making Christian higher education affordable for all with generous financial aid packages available. At Bethany, you'll find stimulating academic programs, a friendly atmosphere, and opportunities to grow both in intellect and in your faith, all within the framework of a supportive Christian environment. For more information, visit us on the web at blc.edu.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/Luther Academy.
Imagine steadfastlutherans.org as the internet version of your neighborhood pub, your neighborhood confessional Lutheran pub, that is, where the finest in Lutheran conversation is going on at every table and at the bar, sometimes contentious, but always informative and unabashedly Lutheran. We're only serving Wittenberg Ale. We even have a guy named Norm, so check us out. www.steadfastlutherans.org. We'll save a seat at the bar for you.
Holy Cross Lutheran Church, Moline, Illinois, invites you to join us in receiving the Lord's gifts in word and sacrament. Sunday services are at 8:15 and 10:45 a.m., with Bible class and Sunday school at 9:30 a.m. We are located in the Quad Cities at 4107 21st Avenue, Moline, Illinois. Welcome in the name of our Lord.
Clear, concise, consistent. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.